Welcome to Homicide: Life on the Set, a podcast about the Emmy Award-winning television show Homicide: Life on the Street, with myself, Chris Carr, and Susan Ingram. On today's podcast, we're joined by director Lee Bodder. Hello, everybody, and I hope you're all well. Now, you could probably hear I've got a bit of a cold, so I apologise about that. But on today's episode, we've got the director, Lee Bodder, who directed three episodes of Homicide. He directed Happy to Be There, Endgame, and he directed the fantastic episode, Requiem for a Dealer. Now, before we get into that, Susan, how are you?
Great, great. I'm so sorry you're sick, Chris. It seems to be going around here, too. So My brother just talked to him this morning and he's got it too. So I hope you feel better soon.
Thank you.
And I just want to say to Lee, it was an absolute pleasure. He welcomed us into his house. And like we say in the episode, first time on location. And thanks to my good friend, Carrie Craven, who also worked on the show. She rode shotgun with me that day. To navigate getting down into the little tiny back roads in Annapolis where Lee's house is on the water. And we had a terrific time. And like I always say, once again, the origin story of how he got into the film business is really interesting. It's also a really great look back at early commercial filmmaking in Baltimore. And then obviously the whole film business in Baltimore. But just the early days, listening to how people got into the business and how he made his way to Homicide is also a really great story.
Yeah, it was a very enjoyable interview. I remember the day where we recorded, it was good fun because obviously you guys had got on location. It was really great and you're in his house. So, thank you again, Lee, for accommodating us in that way.
Also wanted to mention that we got a lovely email from Lisa Matthews, who was in the group Love Riot, who they were formed in 1993, and Jim Yashimura had heard their song Killing Time, and they ended up playing in the subway during the subway episode in 1997 in season 6. And we did want to give them a plug. They have come back together after 26 years apart, and sorry for the late notice, but they're having a show at the Creative Alliance in Highland Town, 3134 Eastern Avenue, on November 21st, Friday, and the event is called It's Been a While, An Evening with Love Riot. So if you're able to drop in and you hear this on Thursday and are able to drop, or Friday and are able to drop in, go have a listen to Love Riot. Go have a listen to Love Riot, who were featured on Homicide. And we're hoping also, perhaps in the future, to have them on the podcast at some point. Also, we'd like to mention we have a new way for you guys to engage with us. We have a page on the website buymeacoffee.com, which allows listeners to drop a few dollars in the bucket and buy us a coffee.
appreciated.
Yeah, we thought it'd be particularly relevant because of all the coffee room scenes in Homicide. So if you can, go to buymeacoffee.com/homicidepoq. Should be Homicide Pod. We're not sure quite why, but so if you go to buymeacoffee.com/homicidepoq for the moment, we may get that changed and buy us a coffee. We'd really appreciate to hear from people. And if you want to throw a little money at us, that would be terrific.
Yeah, any change would be more than welcome, especially coming from a coffee addict here. Thank you in advance. And yeah, sorry about it being Homicide POQ. We're still trying to investigate why that is, but that's the handle that the buy us a coffee has given us, and don't seem to have an option to edit that at this time. So we will endeavor to investigate and see if we can get that changed so it's a bit more on brand. But thank you again, everybody, for that. So without further ado, I think we'll get into our interview with Lee Bodder, and we will catch you on the other side. Today we're joined by Lee Bonner, who's a fantastic director who's worked on 3 episodes of Homicide, and Susan is on location at Lee's home. So Lee, welcome to the podcast. And Susan, tell us a little bit about where you are.
Yeah, so yes, we're in Lee's lovely house in Annapolis. This is the first time we have done a location interview. So we are on location with Lee Bonner, and I have lovely assistant Carrie Craven with us.
Thank you,
who helped me get help me navigate to get down here. And also, Carrie was the assistant production coordinator. Is that the correct title? Assistant production coordinator on Homicide for seasons 1 and 2. So I'm threatening that she needs to come on and talk to us as well.
Oh yes, that'd be great.
Because we don't have a lot of season 1 stuff because I didn't work on season 1. So yeah, so terrific. We are, his house is right on the water. So it's a lovely, lovely location. Thank you for inviting us down, Lee.
My pleasure.
Yeah, it's wonderful to have you on the podcast. So I suppose to just kick us off, can you tell us a little bit about how you kind of got started in the film industry and how you ended up working on Homicide?
Okay, well, I started out as a commercial artist. I worked at a couple of art studios, and then I became an art director at an advertising agency, Ray Finn Advertising, and they started doing TV commercials. So I was an art director on TV commercials, and we were doing a tourism commercial in Ocean City, and I met a director named Garrett Brown, and we became friends, and doing all the commercials convinced me I wanted to get into the film business instead of the art business. So I got a call from a place called Eucalyptus Tree Studio, that was a very popular art studio. And I said I would come with them with the understanding that we would also do TV commercials. So I started directing a few TV commercials for them. But I realized that people don't come to an art studio to get commercials. They come to a film studio. So I had to leave Eucalyptus Tree. Although while I was there, I made a commercial for the Baltimore Zoo.
Oh, nice. Baltimore Connection. Cool.
Which won a gold medal at the New York Art Directing Show.
Nice.
Which was pretty unbelievable. And the commercial was a lot of fun. It was kids' voices. I got my little kids and a bunch of their friends came over, and I recorded them saying all these, I like the elephant, and I like the giraffe, but I like the whatever, and I would feed him a few lines, and then we got on the zoo train and filmed it with adults having the kids' voices.
I think I remember that ad.
Yeah, well, it had Sheldon Cohen.
Yeah,
Sheldon's in it, a bunch of people were in it.
So the adults are on the tram going through the zoo, but when they talk, it's
the kids' voice. Yeah. And one kid brought an animal book with him, and he's in my book. He's in my book too. And then, and so Sheldon, when we did the filming, I brought a book, and he would say, he's in my book.
Oh, that's funny.
It really came out. And then I had this very pretty woman say, what are those monkeys doing? And, I fed that line to one of the kids, knowing what the monkeys were doing, but the kids wouldn't know what the monkeys were doing.
Oh, brilliant.
And that's because every time I went to the zoo, that's what the monkeys were doing. It's like, good grief. But anyway, so I, at the advertising agency, I was doing a commercial in Ocean City, a tourism commercial, and the director they sent me was Garrett Brown, and I thought, who is this? I normally had their regular director. Who is this guy? So by the end of the day, I was very happy with that guy as a director. And we became good friends. He was a big sailor, and so was I. And just, you know, we just hit it off. So when I got to the point where I started my own film company, I would get a storyboard or a script, and I would say, oh, wow, this would be great done on Steadicam. And I can get Garrett Brown to do it. And so, of course, I got every single commercial that right. I did because of Garrett.
He was hot then.
Right? Oh, yeah. And, you know, people in the business
Steadicam.
Knew him. Right. Well, yeah. And the funny thing is, I heard about the Steadicam from Barry Levinson, because he wanted to use it on The Natural. When Redford comes out of this long tunnel, and the Steadicam would have come out. I mean, I don't know. That was Skycam.
Oh, Skycam. Was that like a Lumicrane? What's a Skycam? Is that like on a cable?
That's what's on every cable. Football.
Yeah,
you
know. Okay. Gotcha. Yeah.
Steadicam's famous by Stanley Kubrick on The Shining, I think. Right. It's one of the early films.
Yeah, you look at Garrett Brown's IMDb page. I mean, amazing that you worked with him right at the get-go.
Yeah.
Of his career.
Yeah, exactly. That's, yeah. You know, because that's right after we had met, you know, probably less than a year after I met him, I was able to hire
him. And then to say, oh, I can get Garrett Brown. I'm sure you got every commercial anybody ever went out for.
And the other funny thing there was, well, I was the first person to use Steadicam on commercials. It had only been done in movies. And then later, when he invented Skycam, Barry had wanted to use him, but it wasn't quite ready. He just couldn't quite get it ready in time.
Garrett Brown invented Skycam too?
Yes.
Is it really?
Yes. So
So Carrie just handed me a list. Dive Cam, Fly Cam, Go Cam, Moby Cam, Safety Mitt, Skycam, and Steadicam. Wow.
I like the idea of Moby Cam, the first submarine tracking camera system. That sounds kind of cool.
Thank you.
Yeah, and when they had swimmers in the Olympics, he'd have a camera underwater that would follow the swimmers. But with Skycam, he couldn't get that to work in time. Mm. And he called me and said, I've got it working. Skycam is working. So I hired him. And I was the first person to use Skycam, period. And but we were doing this bank shoot, and there was a park, and the bank was right on the park. So he put the blocks for the
where's the cables
for the cables on four corners of a building.
Right.
And he was getting it set up, and all of a sudden, one of the cables pulled out of the building, shot down.
God.
And hit the ground like a foot from somebody walking by. It would have killed him.
It would have killed him. Oh, my golly.
And the reason that happens is because the invention isn't working. And it has to, when one pulls, the other has to release.
Right, because it has all,
And this had two pulleys.
The pulleys, yeah.
Mm-mm. Yeah.
And pulleys working simultaneously.
Right.
In every direction.
We didn't get to shoot it, but I was the first person to use Steadicam on a commercial, and the first person to use Skycam, period, even though it didn't work. And so anyway, that's he is how I got into the commercial business by saying I could get
great launching pad into filmmaking. Wow, amazing. Are you still in touch with him?
Not much anymore, but we were in touch for a long time. He's a big sailor, and he keeps a sailboat on the Chesapeake Bay. He lives in Philadelphia, but he keeps a boat on the bay up north so that he can come down.
All this secret information. I didn't know Garrett Brown has a boat on the Chesapeake Bay.
Did you ever go sailing with Clark Johnson? Because apparently he's a big sailor himself.
Was he really?
Yeah, apparently.
No, I didn't know that. So the film company, my company, like most film companies at the time, you know, commercial film companies, not movies, consisted of me, a secretary, receptionist, bookkeeper, a producer, an assistant producer, and that's it. Mm. All of the other crew were freelance, and you hired them just for the job. And that's the way they work. They work freelance for all the different film companies and, you know, other possibilities. So one of them was, one of the people that I hired was Diana Mona, and she did hair, makeup, and wardrobe. And when I got separated from my first wife, she kept trying to hook me up with her younger sister, Denise. And Denise wanted nothing to do with a guy who was 10 years older and had four children. So she would never meet with me. And then somehow Diana tricked her into going someplace, and there I was. So we met, and amazingly, we hit it off immediately and have been together ever since. And you end up getting married.
And that will become a connection to Homicide, and he will let us know.
Right. There you go. Right.
All that happenstance.
Denise and I only have one child, but he's now 36 years old, and he is in the film business working for Taylor Sheridan on Yellowstone, Landman, Lioness.
And Frank, do you remember Frank Farrow, the assistant director? Frank's working on Lioness.
Yeah,
so he's working with Frank.
Chris Paul, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, good. Wow. Yeah.
And he's assistant directing and
assistant director.
Is he? Mm-hmm. Cool.
So then Diana worked for Barry Levinson when he came to town to do Diner, and they got together, and one thing led to another, and eventually they got married. So Barry Levinson became my brother-in-law.
Oh, wow. There we go.
So that's how I got introduced to Homicide. Diana, you know, when he first started working on it, said, Barry's going to produce it, but you're going to direct every episode.
There you go.
And I ended up doing three.
So that's how you got to Homicide.
Right.
Since you were connected at that point with Barry, how far ahead did you hear about it? You heard about it before it started and before it was being produced or anything?
I heard about it way before it started. I heard about it when he had the idea and he started working and creating it. And I was waiting to do all the episodes.
Right, all the episodes.
But it didn't work out that way.
And so once you saw it, once it came on, because you started in season three, once you saw seasons one and two, were you, because you obviously were still, you know, very popular director here and working all the time in commercials and other films and your own films. Were you interested once, or like, even though they said you were going to direct every episode, once you saw what it was, did that pique your interest and make you more interested?
Because it was very unique style.
Right.
It was different than anything else. And, I like that.
Right. Obviously. So you also did a feature film before Homicide called The Adventure of the Action Hunters, which it originally was called Two for the Money.
Right.
Kind of a cult classic because it has Baltimore talent like former Colt defensive tackle Artie Donovan, who also, I believe, I remember working with Artie Donovan. So he was either in a Homicide episode or he was a cameo in one of John's pictures. But I remember a scene with Artie sitting on the stoop of a Baltimore row house. And I should look up and see whether it was Homicide or whether it was one of John's pictures. And then also Stu Kerr and David Du Bois are in it. So you were doing your own films and directing commercials when Homicide came along.
Right.
Correct?
Right.
And when you started directing season three, so we're down here now. Okay. So when we started, you started directing season three, 1994, with Happy to Be Here, with Joe Morton.
Great actor.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
One thing I wanted to mention about Two for the Money.
Sure.
We got Trauma Entertainment to release the film, and they retitled it The Adventure of the Action Hunters, which is the opposite of what it was. It was
marketing for you.
Yeah. it was Adventure of the Action Avoiders.
Right, trying to get away
from everything and everybody, and they just kept getting in trouble. But if you wanted to go see the Adventure of the Action Hunters and then you watch that, it's exactly the opposite of what you wanted to see. Right. So it kind of killed the movie, never did anything.
It's really fun, though. I would say for Baltimore people or anybody, I watched it on Tubi, right? I think it's on Tubi.
Is it?
And this is another thing that struck me, because then you ended up on Homicide, where we did a lot of night work. But your first feature, you picked a period piece. It takes place in the 1940s. And almost all of it is shot at night, which are two of the most absolutely challenging things you could do as a filmmaker. So maybe you got through a lot of those kind of challenges before you even got to the Homicide challenges, right?
Yeah, I'm not sure why we made it a period piece, and it had to be a lot of night because of
it was a film noir too. It was an homage for sure.
But we bought this boat that was so cheap, it was unbelievable, and it was sinking. Well, you know, we had to constantly have somebody go down there every day and pump it, or else it would have sunk. And we built sets for all the interior. So everything, anytime they were inside the boat, they were in a set. And, you know, it was like maybe three different sets of different sections of the boat. And when we finished filming, we burned the sets and filmed them burning. And then when it exploded, it was going to explode, burn to the waterline, and you would see all that stuff. And we had the Loazzo family.
The Loazzo family, who are famous for, what's the word for that? Blowing stuff up?
Yeah, but it
pyrotechnics, the famous pyrotechnic family here. And one of the Loazzos, Tom Loazzo, was also in the film business.
Right, well, he wasn't in the other business.
He wasn't in the other business, but he was.
And he died very young.
Yes, he did.
But it's how we knew him.
Right.
And we told the guy, so talking about...
You cannot rustle that
right,
too much.
Right, gotcha. Talk about filming at night. When you film at night, you have to film at dusk. There's a certain period when it's bright enough that the camera can see, but the sky looks dark. And then when you darken it down, it looks like night. But if you wait too late, then you're in trouble. Well, the Loazzos, not being in the film business like their cousin, or whatever he was, got there late. And also, though, that was hilarious, because I used to do all of WJZ's television commercials, Baltimore Television Network. And Oprah Winfrey was there at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And she, we were good friends. And she came to watch the explosion of the boat, as a bunch of people did. Mm. And since they weren't allowed to be there, they were all hiding back in the woods and up in trees. Imagine Oprah being up there. And anyway, so they blew it up too late. And it
in full dark. It was fully dark
in
the film. Yeah.
But it was bright enough that you could see it. But also they said everybody has to be behind this wall that they put up before we're going to blow it up. And so Arthur Ang, who was our assistant cameraman, got the cameras rolling, but then it was so dark he fell in a ditch. And you know, here the camera's rolling, and you know, finally he got back just in time, so they blew it up and it just disappeared.
Yeah.
It, you know, it didn't burn the waterline, it just disappeared.
It disintegrated the boat.
Yeah.
Great.
But in
you
this,
see the film, it just goes boosh.
Yeah, and it's gone. There's nothing there. But today we could fix that with today's technology, you know. But we couldn't at the time, editing on a moviola with film.
Oh my gosh.
So that was another interesting thing, that we had just shot all the sets burning down.
Right. So anybody out there, like, we need to like remaster that film and re-release it, because it is really fun and it would look great if it was remastered. And you could brighten it up a little so you could see that explosion a little better, or see the boat.
We definitely been wanting to do that for years. Lee Felsmo.
Here's your time. Give your pitch. Here's your chance.
I just found the trailer for
anybody
it.
Anybody out there?
Just found a trailer for it. You're talking. I'm now watching
Trauma
the
Entertainment still exist?
Oh, that's funny. Yeah, I've seen it. I mean, on television.
Does Trauma still exist?
I don't know. But the problem with us redoing it is we can't find, we don't have the original.
Oh, the negative?
Negative, or even the original film. All we have are these low-quality videos.
Oh, wow.
And we just couldn't do it with
Okay,
it.
Whoever out there has the original negatives, fess up.
Get it,
Get it
to us quick.
Cool.
Because also, we noticed that if we made a few changes in editing, which would be extremely easy to do today, it would work much better. Because that was the first film we ever made, and you know, you learn things by doing them, and then it's like, but unfortunately, it's too late because it's done.
Right.
But anyway,
yeah.
So go ahead.
Just looking at the video of it, the boat kind of jumps out and then explodes. It's quite an interesting. So I just found it on YouTube, that bit.
It levitates.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So you came on to Homicide after that, season 3, episode 7, which was Happy to Be Here, which starts with a sex scene with Kyle, and I should know the actress's name, but I don't, Emma Zuhl. Isn't that?
No, well, it actually starts with it actually starts after that. So hang on. It starts with a little piece in the coffee room with Pembleton, Munch, and Megan Russert, and they're talking about something
joke,
we can measure.
About here
yeah,
to here,
yeah,
here, here.
And then she's
what
sort of,
that
yeah,
measurement is.
Yeah,
right.
And then she says there's one the guys can do, which then. It's a very funny little moment.
Yeah.
But it struck me. So you got to direct, I mean, the first couple seasons of Homicide, there was no romance. There was no sex at all. When they got to season 3, they started sort of throwing that in. Yeah. And so it's Kyle and Emma Zuhl. I'm sorry. I don't know the actress's name. In the coffin.
Yeah. Lauren Tom's the actress, and she went on to play Ross's girlfriend in Friends. And she's recently been in an episode of Poker Face.
Well, interesting.
Yeah.
Oh,
good.
So, and Joe Morton was also in that episode. That was the episode where he plays the head of the black newspaper in Baltimore. And I think I might have worked with him, too, on something else. And I should have looked up what it was. So do you have any recollections of first coming on the show? I know, I think, and you can tell us about this. I think you had said earlier that you came in, Barry asked you to come in, and you got a chance to meet everybody before you came on to direct.
What happened was Barry directed an early episode, and I went to visit, you know, because he's in Baltimore, and I went to visit, and I met the crew and the cast, and the crew, although we were in Baltimore, I didn't know most of them.
Really?
Oh, yeah, I knew some, but not most. Mm-hmm. You know, like that cameraman who's Jean.
Right.
He's a gunslinger.
You kind of Boots. You know, Boots probably worked with you on some commercials. Boots Shelton, the camera assistant.
Yeah, I'm sure he did. Mm-hmm. Definitely.
So,
you know, I got to meet them, and I got to meet the cast, and that made it a lot easier, you know, going in and doing it. And then Barry did another episode, and I came to visit it as usual. And he started using a long lens, which had never been used on Homicide. And I always use, you know, all kinds of lenses, because sometimes a wide angle tells what you want to tell better. Sometimes medium, and sometimes a telephoto just gets you in on something and get rid of everything else. And Barry was using it, so I talked to Jean and said, "Oh, we gotta use that. We gotta do more of that." Mm-hmm. And he said, "Oh yeah, this is great. We will."
Yeah, because his most of what he liked to do was wide, and if he wanted a close up, he would push in with a wide lens.
With a wide lens,
as opposed to using a tighter lens, which is a totally different look.
Oh yeah, completely.
Yeah.
And it makes your face a little distorted, but anyway, and I learned early on that in the television business, episodic television, if the producer doesn't like anything that you do, you hear about it immediately the next morning, and then you don't do it anymore. And we never heard from what's his name,
Tom
Fontana. We never heard anything from Tom, so we just kept getting more extreme and doing more things that they never had done. And I thought, wow, fantastic. So the way it worked was you'd film here, and then you would go to New York, where Tom had an office and a place, and you would edit. And also, when you edit, the producer doesn't watch until the end because he wants it to hit him the way it'll hit the audience, you know, not knowing what's coming, where if he does it, it's harder to judge what it is. So I went up, finished shooting that, and I went up and walked in and said, "Hey, Tom, you know, so how'd you like the dailies?" And he said, "I've been in Europe." He says, "I haven't seen a thing."
And that's what I did, getting them.
Of all the ones not to see a thing.
So I went
in and edited.
Yeah.
You know, he didn't see it until I was finished. So I finished and left and went home. And the next morning, got a phone call from Diana, Barry's wife, my wife's sister, who said, "Tom Fontana called Barry this morning and said he just saw one of the best episodes we've ever done." So,
right. And that was which one? Was that Requiem for Dina?
That was Requiem for Dina.
That was the third one that you did.
Yeah.
Which is really that story arc with Kyle and Tim Bayless's character, with obviously the little girl and his first case and is never solved, which was parallel to the LaTanya Wallace case in Baltimore, which also is never solved. That was a huge story arc throughout the whole show, season, you know, 1 to season 7.
Yeah.
So you jumped in with a very heavy, already pre-proscribed story that Kyle had been going through, that Tim Bayless' character had been going through. Did you have a chance to look at Three Men and a Dina, or had you seen all the episodes leading up to it to be able to, because that was a heavy piece.
And there's some flashbacks also, as well. Yeah. Yeah.
And also it was one of the best episodes. Mm. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
And remember, like in pre-production or anything, you got to
I must have, but yeah. I can't remember that, sure. You know, that detail.
Yeah. I just watched I watched all your episodes twice. And, the thing that was so good about Requiem for Dina, well, many things were really good about it, but the interplay between Andre Brower's character, Frank Pemberton, and Kyle, was really striking in how much they were basically fighting through the whole episode.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
And I think it also might have been a sort of tipping point for Kyle's character, who had been this sort of, you know, very naive, sort of hopeful character. And it really is part of the arc where he becomes a much darker character as the seasons go on. And also it did strike me, and I don't know if you remember, if you just watched the episode, you would remember that how angry in some of the scenes, how angry Andre got. And the one, and I have to ask you if you remember, the one scene in the coffee room where he pushes Richard Belzer across the room and Belzer actually falls down and into a very violent sort of scene.
Yeah.
Do you remember that? And if it was rehearsed that way?
I don't remember.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
The thing that was striking too is I thought, I don't think Tom had at that point pre-thought Andre's stroke. But Andre is so angry and hyped up through it. It almost as if the story arc is already building for the stroke.
There is a line that,
yes,
I think definitely, yeah, yeah, about don't burst a blood vessel.
Yeah, you're going to burst a blood vessel. So it was interesting that was a very heavy, really heavy, but also really beautiful, a beautiful episode, because he had to let go. Kyle in that episode had to let go of his obsession with the Adina Watson case. And at the end, there's that beautiful shot as he puts all of his mementos of that case into a manila envelope and drops it in the trash. That's one of the last shots. And then you did a close up on the manila envelope as it went into the trash can. That was beautiful. And no wonder they called and said it was one of the best episodes. And did that make Barry jealous?
Well,
Barry, did that make you jealous?
For whatever reason, I never got hired again.
Oh, no.
Yeah, interesting.
Here's the best episode we ever did. Let's never use that guy again. You know, we don't want to be that good.
Because at that point, that was season 7.
No.
Right?
No, 4.
Season 4, episode 4. Like, what, 15 or 18 or something like that.
So
there were still 5, 6, and
7.
Did you ever, Barry, why did you never hire him again?
Jealousy.
You should ask him. That's so funny.
Yeah. A couple of fun things on this second episode. And they had we did a lot of stuff on the block, which is where all the strip joints were in downtown Baltimore at that time.
And that was Endgame. That was the one with Steve Buscemi.
Yeah.
Played the murderer.
Yeah. And Steve Buscemi, we used his brother in a movie that I did as a voiceover. Because I can't remember anything. I can't remember the other guy, but that was when you were talking about Replay.
Was that Replay? Oh, yeah. So that's Steve Buscemi's brother's voice?
Yeah.
As he played the detective that's trying to figure out the crime?
Right. It was Michael Buscemi.
Huh.
And the other guy was he was on Early Edition, when the TV show where the guy would get the newspaper a day early.
I wrote that down somewhere.
So he knew. But anyway, the fun thing about being on the block is we had to go scout all of these strip joints. And we went into this one, and there's this woman up there, like, practicing. And they said, see her? They said, that's really a guy dressed up as a girl. I'm not sure what happened when he stripped. But his name is Amanda. And they said, a man, duh, because he was a man.
No.
Really? Yeah.
The block.
That wasn't in our show, but right. It was just something that happened while scouting, and it was just pretty
scary. Right, because Steve Buscemi's character, haunts the massage parlor, so that's why we ended up looking for him on the block.
And I had Denise was in it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, being interviewed on the street, and so was her sister. And then so was their brother's wife, but their brother's wife got cut out. I didn't cut her out, but they did. So that was funny.
I also wondered, Brooke and Jeff were also cameos in, I think, Happy to Be Here. And I wonder if you had any say on, like, oh, get Brooke and Jeff to come in and be the extras. You don't remember that?
No.
Brooke Yatton and Jeff Gordon, because they named the Steve Buscemi character Gordon Pratt, and Jeffrey Pratt Gordon, who was one of the prop guys. They used to like to use crew names, for some of the characters. So they just inverted Jeff's name and used him brilliant. For the Steve Buscemi character.
That's good.
So do you have any memories of directing Steve Buscemi or Chris Rock in the Requiem for Adina?
Chris Rock was great, very good to work with, and thoroughly enjoyed him. And Andre Brouwer was my favorite. He was just so good. He would get his lines wrong, but he was so convincing you didn't even notice. and then the script person would tell you, that should have been something different. But he was just so good, and he always called me the visionary. The visionary. And whenever I would, make a suggestion, the way I direct is I don't boss people around. I make suggestions and toss it around. And he always gave me the impression that he thought that my idea was so stupid. But he was so good that he would make it work anyway. But I never, who knows, what he's really thinking. But and he was always, we always got along great. So, but I was never quite sure, you know. And I was out in L.A. doing a commercial, and I was walking across the parking lot to my car, and somebody called out my name back behind me, and I looked around, and it was him. So I figured, well, he must like me okay, or he wouldn't do that.
Right, if he didn't like you, he would have gone the other way, right? Yeah. Oh, geez, there's Lee Bonner.
Oh, my God, not him. But anyway, a lot of fun, a lot of fun.
One process question. Coming in as a director on an established show, it's quite complex because working with actors who already have really established characters, as you sort of alluded to with Frank Pembleton, played by Andre Brau, what approaches did you use to help you kind of navigate working with the established cast? Did you visit the sets or anything prior to production? Or
definitely. Barry's episodes, you know, I would visit every day. I you know, come there and hang out and get to know the cast and get to know the crew and see how they did everything. So when I came in to do it, I sort of, you know, was in the groove there.
Yeah, yeah, and you kind of fit in. That's brilliant. Yeah.
Well,
do you remember sort of jumping off that question about the cast and working with them? It obviously there were many scenes where there were multiple people in the scene and the camera moving through everybody and moving around. Did you have any feel for that kind of filmmaking? Because I think you had you done some documentary work before then, or mostly all commercials? I'm just wondering about coming into that not traditional filmmaking style, and if you liked it or if it was frustrating.
No, I liked
challenging.
I liked it a lot, and I saw it, you know, going on when I would visit the set, and I liked it. John was amazing stuff he could do, but one problem with it was we would do a scene, and you know, he'd come into one of the people this way, great, okay, take two, and he came in another way, and I would say, John, you know, we've got to edit this. Certain things, that's fine, but other things, if the guy's looking to the right, the other guy needs to be looking to the left, I'd end up editing, and like, here's the best take of this, and here's the best take of this, except they can't go together. But Jean never quite could do that. And then he directed an episode. And after he directed an episode, he never did that again, ever. He always came to the right side. Now, I liked him a lot, and I definitely do. If that makes it sound like I'm calling him stupid, don't use it.
No, yeah. And I think the editors and the producers did like the jump cuts and I think the idea of like, are we jumping the line, like screen direction line, which makes the scene look confusing. I could totally understand that, but I think you came in season 3 and 4. And I think that some of the jump cutty style was a little more diffused. By the time you came in, that it wasn't perhaps as jagged as it was by season 3 and 4.
Well, but the thing is, some of that works fine. It just doesn't work if I'm talking to somebody and I'm looking that way. You can't cut it
right.
So
I'm agreeing that what you were asking to do is probably what in some cases made the show look less jagged, because you were shooting and you know, trying to get some of those more traditional close-ups and overs and with the correct screen direction and everything. Yeah.
But the fact that after he directed one and had to edit it and found out that those things didn't work right, he never did it again. I thought that was pretty funny.
And I think in watching those episodes, and Chris, you can, and you can jump in too, I think there was more use, and your second episode was actually Alex Zakshevsky shot the second episode, because Jean must have been prepping another episode to direct. So Alex shot Endgame, shot the Steve Buscemi one, I think.
Huh.
And Alex, it's pretty clear once Alex took over in season 5, Alex much more preferred closer lenses. So, and you can see that in the episode you directed that Alex shot, that there's probably more close-ups and more use of, I think, a more use of the long lenses, because that was something that you liked too. And I know Alex liked to be in closer as opposed to be back here, push in with a wide lens.
Yeah, well, you mix it up because some things are better telephoto and some things are better wide, you know.
Absolutely.
Tells the story.
Yeah. And do you have any feel for, well, I had a question from prior to when you started talking about the editing suite, the editing room. Did you have a week of prep beforehand?
Yeah.
And so you got to go to some of the locations and things, or anything that stand out in those three episodes that were location-wise challenging?
No, because
you'd already been shooting on a boat on the water in the dark, so you already had some challenging situations, right?
Yeah, no, that I didn't have any problem with that.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any memories of sort of what it's like as a TV director, you know, working on Homicide? What kind of like a typical day was, you know, did you, you know, what kind of time of day do you arrive? You know, what was the sort of process of working, you know, like do rehearsals and then shoot, etc.? You know, what was the sort of typical day like on Homicide, if there is a typical day, if you remember?
Well, but to me, it was the same as anything you do. But episodic, you come in Monday morning early and you shoot, and then Tuesday is later and later, so that Friday you come in late and do all your night stuff. So that was just, you know, kind of standard. And what you would do was each scene, you'd rehearse and, you know, get all the camera moves and all the actors moves right. And then you'd shoot. And then they'd have to light, because that's based on where everybody's going to be and where they're moving. And while they're lighting, the actors are getting makeup and wardrobe fixed. And then it's lit, they come out and they shoot it. And we have stand-ins for when they're lighting. So when the actors leave, when they're lighting it to match what you did, we have stand-ins. Then they come out, we shoot, you know, the first angle, the second angle, you know, however many shots there are, and then move on to the next scene and do the whole same thing all over.
So there was an ability to move more quickly because the camera was on somebody's shoulder. So when you went off and you did do some Dick Wolf TV shows and some David Kelly TV shows, like The Practice and Profiler, where everything's on a tripod or a dolly, which means the setup is going to take longer to change and longer to move around. Did you have any feel for how different that was as a director to be more locked? Did you like being more locked in on the more traditional kind of filmmaking? Or talk about those differences.
Think
about it.
Again, I don't know exactly how to describe it. I liked both. It was very enjoyable to work with Jean and do all that moving. But I also like the other stuff, you know, so can't really say.
So you were able to switch back and forth.
Yeah.
And
to me, that's part of the enjoyment of the film making, the creativity and the changing and the challenges are the most fun.
Right.
And, you know, when I am directing, I make a shot list for myself. And when I figure out, okay, this could be a problem, we might not be able to do this, I have a backup for it. So that helps very much when you're on the set working, because you keep moving faster.
Right, right. Absolutely.
All the episodes of television shows I ever did, they would always say, if you could only get us out of here faster. And I did every single time. I did it fast.
Right.
And, you know, not bad or skipping stuff, but having it planned in advance.
Yeah. I like that comment that the challenge is what makes it fun. And I think that's why everybody liked in general working on Homicide, because it was every day was different, and every day there was some kind of challenging situation.
Yeah.
that people had to face, the crew had to face, or the actors and everybody and the directors. Do you have a feel for why? Well, this is a question we ask everybody's. The show, when you watch it now, and I don't know if you felt this when you watch it, except for an hairdo here and there, maybe some shoulder pads and a jacket, the show does not feel dated. It feels very, it still feels current. It doesn't feel old fashioned. Did you have a sense when you watched your episodes, maybe why it still feels so? I mean, that was a long time ago, and it doesn't feel old when you watch it.
Yeah. And I think that's largely because it was such a different thing that it doesn't get old. It doesn't look old, you know, because it's so unique.
Right. Yeah, I think it being ahead of its time. And also, there were so many social, racial, sexual, class issues that were confronted head on.
Yeah.
There was no mincing words in that show about all those kind of controversial things because the scripts were so well written.
Yeah.
That I think also made it ahead of its time, in addition to technically the way we shot it. Yeah, that the stories and the dialogue that really hit things frontal, you know, full in your face, with no apologies, I think helped make it still feel new.
Yeah.
Lee, do you have any sort of memories of sort of working with the cast?
They all so interesting and so themselves that it just, you know, it was always enjoyable. I'm sorry I can't come up with.
No, that's fine. One question I did have, just a technical one, about the casting process. Were you, as a guest director, I'm assuming you are involved in the casting of the guest actors, so people like Steve Buscemi, Chris Rock, etc. Were you involved in that process?
You know, in any other kind of film you do, you're definitely involved in that. But I feel like that's all done before I get there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, it might be. It might well be. Yeah.
I think it is.
Yeah, because it was such a machine to keep moving.
And also episodic television. I eventually ended up getting out of it because when they want something, they won't tell you what they want. They want you to do what you want. And then.
Yeah.
When they edit it, they want to change it to what they originally wanted. And, you know, I would say to them, because I got to know all of these people very well, you know, it was like, tell me what you want. And if I think that's wrong, I'll tell you what I think. And then we can make a decision and shoot it that way so that in the end, you don't have to go back and try to change it. And that happened all the time because you're there for a week rehearsing while a show is being shot, and then you're shooting while that show is being edited, and then you're editing while they're trying to change the other thing. And, you know, you see it all. You see it before, during, and after.
Right.
And I just couldn't get them to tell me what they wanted.
Huh.
And maybe they didn't know.
Well, yeah, some people don't know what they want until they see it.
Yeah.
And then they're like, oh, yeah. That's the other problem in this business, I think.
I definitely ended up or watched them trying to change things constantly. And so.
Yeah, and you worked on quite a few. I made a couple notes here. Some of the episodic you worked on, Maloney with Peter Strauss and The Practice with Dylan McDermott. And Sins of the City with Jose Zuniga, and if that's how I pronounce it incorrectly. An early edition, I'm going to go back and look at that because I was a newspaper reporter for 20 years. And that was about a guy who gets the paper the day before the things actually happen. I have to go look at that.
That was fun.
He
was great. We got along very well and had a good time.
And then Profiler with Ali Walker.
Yeah.
And Robert Darby, who is my favorite James Bond villain.
Oh, really? And which one
was
he?
Yeah, really interesting actor.
Which was that?
He was in License to Kill, the film, the Bond movie. He was Fran Sanchez, and then he was obviously in Profiler.
Oh, Profiler.
I've forgotten his character's name now.
There's a picture of Alex with Ali Walker.
Oh,
my little boy.
Oh, really?
he was my son.
Which, where am I looking?
On the far
on
left.
On the shelf?
Not the far left, the next one over, where she's leaning down and he's standing next to her. Yeah.
I love it.
And that, there's one of Robert Davi there, too.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah. I wonder who else is random. I love Tony LoBianco. Do you remember working with him? He came in on Endgame to help them find the shooter, to find the Steve Buscemi character. And he was a New York detective. I guess I would assume he was, maybe he wasn't supposed to be New York. It's maybe supposed to be a Baltimore detective from another division.
Yeah, I think he was like a different division. I wondered if they were kind of like maybe bringing him in and the other actress in, but he never did. But I thought it was really good.
Because he was a big name then. Mm. Do you remember working with him at all, Tony LoBianco? I love him. I don't
remember, but I can't remember names.
Yeah. Before we wrap up with the last couple questions, I did want to ask because I didn't get a chance to watch Replay. Now, Replay was done from the point of view of a surveillance camera with the detective, which I think you said was Michael Buscemi's voice.
And the guy from Early Edition.
Oh, okay. And
What's his name?
I don't know. I don't have that written down for some
reason. Hang on. I'm just checking now. So when was Replay made?
2003.
Replay was first called 21 Eyes because it was 21 surveillance.
Oh, it was 21. Oh, okay.
And what made it unique and what made it, to me, a great idea is you see things from one angle. You see everything that's happening because that's that one camera. And then, so then they pick up another one and that's some camera somewhere else shooting. And so you don't get to know what this guy's looking at when he looks over there. And then you figure it out later. So the detectives are watching all of these videos. So we see the videos on the screen. We see some reflections in the glass of the screen, like the people coming and going that pop in. And the viewer is in the detective's chair, literally.
Mm-hmm.
And so, whenever anybody watches a mystery, they try to figure out how it's going to end. So this says, can you beat the detectives and figuring out what really happened.
Was it a feature or a pilot or a TV show?
It's a feature.
It was.
And
apparently streaming on Tubi.
Was it really?
Apparently.
I'm going to go watch
apparently.
It.
Apparently. I'm going to check it out because that sounds fantastic. I had an idea similar to that a long time ago. I was fascinated by CCTV and stuff. But
Now it's called Do You See What I See?
Oh, okay.
So that's the latest title.
Yeah, and of course, and what do they say? How many thousands of surveillance cameras are there around London? It's some.
Oh, loads.
It's
like
some amazing number that literally you can leave your house and go anywhere and you will be on camera the entire time.
Yeah. The funny thing is, when there's a major crime, they can never find people because they're all really bad resolution or spiders on it or something. But yeah. Oh, God. Yeah. But no, to be honest, CCTV, like there was a very big murder 2 years ago during, 3 years ago now, during COVID, which involved a policeman murdering a woman. And they caught him in 24 hours because a CCTV on a bus happened to pass the car when he grabbed her. And then they got the registration and they could track the car through all the other CCTV and they got him. I mean, sadly, she died, but they got him within 24 hours.
Wow.
One of the most horrendous recent cases in London, London Metropolitan Police's history. It's terrible, but yeah.
Yeah. So that mole, I love that mole. Yeah. That their whole surveillance thing is a great idea for a film. So yeah. I'm going to go watch that.
Yeah. Yeah, I look forward to seeing that. That's really cool.
And he also mentioned, because I was wondering other experiences you wanted to mention, and that also was something I have to go look up. I hadn't heard about.
Yeah, well, the band that wouldn't die was for the sports network. What is that?
ESPN.
ESPN? Yeah.
Oh, ESPN, yeah.
Yeah, okay, yeah. And they did, on their 30th anniversary, they did 30 video or, you know, movies about sports, but not about the sport itself, things that were associated with it. And so this was about the Baltimore Colts marching band. And what is unique about that kind of a thing is there's no script, and it writes itself as it goes along.
And that was Barry. Barry directed that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Barry, but direct, it's a completely different kind of directing. You know, it's organizing how everything is going to go, but there are no actors. So they don't, you know, you don't direct actors. You ask them questions. And like the thing, the working title was The Band Played On. And we were interviewing the band and, you know, one of the many, many things we shot. And one guy said, we hid the, what happened and what it's about is when the Colts were moved to Indianapolis, the uniforms were at the cleaners. So the band uniforms were at the cleaners. So the band got all of their uniforms and hid them so that, you know, Louisiana couldn't come back and get them. And the guys.
You mean Indiana?
I mean, Indianapolis. But so at one point the uniforms were hidden in a graveyard, in a, you know,
like a crypt or a vault.
Yeah, a vault. And the guy said when the press found out, they started to call us the band that wouldn't die. And I just thought, that's it. You know, it's not going to be The Band Played On. It's going to be The Band That Wouldn't Die. And I looked over at Barry and he had this big grin on his face. But what was so interesting was he used my production company because he said, I've got to have somebody in Baltimore. I can't use my LA people or New York people because somebody has to be there because you suddenly get called to shoot something. And he's not going to be there all the time. You know, he came for however, I think it was probably only a week, but maybe it was more than that. But he interviewed it. But then things just come out, like Governor Schaefer, who was the governor of Maryland. At the time that happened, Barry definitely wanted him to speak. But at the time he was sick, he was almost dying. He was in a home and he could never do anything. So then suddenly one day when Barry was in New York, he called and said, Schaefer is, they said he's having a great day and we could come over and film him. Mm-hmm. So I went and did it because Barry wasn't here. And it ended up being one of the best things in the movie because Schaefer had gotten the band together to play because they were having these meetings at the State House and they were going to decide whether they were going to give money to make a new football stadium or not. And he got the band down there to play with all the government people hearing it to get them in the mood. And the band had the instructions or directions to get there were all screwed up and they couldn't find anything. So the trombone player or a trombone player figured it out and he started playing the Colts song on his trombone in downtown Annapolis. And all these band members who were trying to find the place went to the sound and that made it happen. Now, that's just insane.
Oh, that's great.
And, you know, and Schaefer was able to tell us that. And then the vote was made and we got the money.
Wow.
To build a stadium.
Yeah. And for people not from Baltimore, what also happened was that the Colts marching band stayed in Baltimore and kept performing here as the Colts marching band, even though the Colts were gone. And then did they transfer into the Ravens marching band?
Yeah.
So they literally never died. They stayed here, even though the team left, which was everybody, I think, really appreciated that
year. That was great.
Fantastic. Well, one last question, because am I rightly you're originally from Baltimore, aren't you?
Right, Towson.
Yeah. That's yeah. So we ask everybody who's ever worked on the show, or at least I like to, because Baltimore's famous for its food, specifically seafood. And I was just wondering if there are any particular places, either when working on Homicide or just in Baltimore, that you used to enjoy going to eat and sort of socialize and things. Or any particular foods that kept you sustained whilst working on Homicide? Because we had the crew were eating gizzards. I think yeah, then the writers were on Scrapple, I think wasn't it? And
I like seafood, but that's
any place down here. We could, if you don't remember anything from Baltimore, any place around Annapolis you like?
Yeah, lots of places.
Mm-hmm.
But my favorite is the Yacht Club.
The Yacht Club,
right? Annapolis Yacht Club.
Oh, nice.
AYC.
Mm.
And you need to be a member or a guest of a member to go there. Mm. But they have the best sushi that I've tasted in town.
Oh,
and
nice.
And so that.
Nice.
I like that. And, but there are lots of good restaurants. Osteria is fabulous. It's on Main Street, right? Halfway up the street.
Uh-huh.
Great stuff.
Cool.
Baltimore, you know, had a bunch of neat Italian restaurants in Little Italy.
Yeah, and one of your episodes, the one with Joe Morton, gets killed in, was it Sabatino's, I think?
Oh, yeah.
In Sabatino's, right. Sabatino's and Cipriani's were the most well-known in that era.
Uh-huh.
Of the Little Italy restaurants.
Yeah.
Mm. Sabatino had the bookmaker salad.
Yeah,
that's
the one we interviewed Danny
Googling
Baldwin.
That.
Was that a week or two ago? And was it Danny that mentioned the bookmaker salad?
Yeah.
Somebody mentioned the bookmaker salad. It's just funny. Yeah.
Yeah.
Very cool.
I just Googled that and figured out how to make it. So I'm going to try and make it myself. But
yeah. Oh, yeah. It's real. Oh, it's good. Yeah.
Yeah, it looks good. Excellent.
Yay.
Cool. Lee, it's been wonderful chatting with you.
Yeah. Thanks, Lee.
My pleasure.
Right, that was Lee Bonner, and I thought that was a really interesting chat, and I was quite fascinated by his description about working with Garrett Brown, who was the inventor of the Steadicam, and himself a director and commercials and things, and how sort of Lee knew him and became quite good friends with him. I thought that was quite interesting, the kind of Kubrick connection to Homicide in a bizarre way via Garrett Brown, you know, the kind of, you take the Kevin Bacon two steps removed from Kevin Bacon game. But anyway, I thought that was quite interesting. But yeah, what are your thoughts on Lee Bonner?
Yeah, I agree. I thought, like I mentioned in the intro, the origin story being a commercial artist and then an art director, and then the transition when the company he worked with started shooting commercials and started directing commercials as an art director, and then comes in contact with Garrett Brown, who was, yes, the inventor of the Steadicam. But it was interesting that Lee, because he knew him so early on in the process, was the first person to use Garrett Brown and Steadicam on a commercial. And it would have been, Garrett also invented Skycam, which is the pulley system that's used, if I'm not mistaken, on NFL games where the camera flies over the stadium. So that's also a Garrett Brown invention. And that if they hadn't had a cable snap the day they were doing the commercial, Lee would have also been the first person to use Skycam on a commercial, but they attempted it but weren't able to.
Yeah.
And I did just want to mention, Garrett invented, not in addition to Steadicam, Divecam, Flycam, GoCam, MobyCam, and I don't know what the safety mitts are, and Skycam as well as Steadicam. So kudos to him. And he is listed, if you look him up, as an inventor, which is really cool. And cool that Lee had such an early crossover with him and is still in contact. And who knew, you know, he's got a boat here somewhere on the Chesapeake Bay. So.
Yeah, somewhere out there at sea.
Right.
Oh,
and I think you mentioned Bound for Glory was the first feature film that Steadicam was utilized on. So it's just an interesting history to hear people that were at, you know, really at the forefront in the beginnings of these kinds of technologies that we take for granted now, and that what has come out of that now, because of post Steadicam, or while Steadicam is still there, now we have the Ronin system too, which is certainly an offshoot of the Steadicam idea.
Oh yeah, totally. It has its roots. Has its roots from helicopter rigs, I think, the Ronin. It's a fascinating thing, but yeah.
Yeah, and I loved his whole story of the feature that he shot, which doesn't have anything to do with homicide. No. But
the exploding boat.
Yeah, but the connections, you know, Tom Loazzo's family did the pyrotechnics, and he was talking about trying to shoot the scene of the boat exploding at magic hour. He didn't call it magic hour, but that time between when the sun sets and it gets dark is considered one of the most beautiful times to shoot in the evening. And you only have about an hour between when it hits the horizon and the light is gone. And they were rushing to try to get that. And they ended up mostly shooting the boat explosion in full dark, which was fun. But in addition to Tom, unfortunately, yes, who died young, another connection between Lee and that film was Artie Donovan, who I mentioned, was in an episode of Homicide as well as being in Lee's film, but I didn't know what episode. So Artie Donovan is in Hostage Part 1. He's sitting on the stoop of a row house, and they have I want to say it was Belzer, but one of the detectives, goes up and chats with him. Artie Donovan, favorite Baltimore character, former football player.
Yeah, that was quite a funny story.
But I love the idea of somebody being able to remaster Lee's film. Unfortunately, he doesn't have the original negatives. So whoever's got those, pull them out, because it was a fairly entertaining film. It would be a nice sort of time capsule of the time.
Yes. And apparently Oprah Winfrey witnessed the explosion, didn't she? She was somewhere in the distance watching it.
Somewhere in the trees, hiding in the trees. Yeah. So funny.
No, and the other thing that popped out for me was Lee's story about filming Requiem for a Dealer, and he and Jean were kind of like pushing the envelope visually, trying out lots of things. And he was saying that usually if you do something, you get a note from the producer the next morning that they don't like it, and they got no notes, and they kind of carried on, and only to discover that Tom Fontana had been away in Europe the whole week, because I hadn't seen anything. So, but luckily it turned out to be one of the best episodes of Homicide, as far as Tom was concerned.
Yeah, that was good. His episodes were quite, or of course you could say all Homicide episodes are distinct and unique, but he had a couple of really interesting ones. The first one, Happy to Be There, we did mention in the podcast, had one of the first, I think, full-on sex scenes in a coffin, of all things, which was fun. And then he got a chance to direct Steve Buscemi, who he had worked on, was it later or prior to that? Later, after that, where Steve Buscemi's brother did the voiceover to his film?
Yeah. I think that might be later, just looking at his IMDb.
Interesting. Do you see what I see? Yeah. Was that film which was from the point of view of surveillance cameras, which is really interesting. Yeah, Replay. Yeah. Also an interesting conversation to get into about the numbers of, especially in London, the numbers of surveillance cameras. And I actually looked it up. And in total, between public and private surveillance cameras in London, 950,000 cameras, 130,000 of which are public surveillance cameras, put up by public agencies. So that gives you an idea of why you can track somebody across London. But interesting, you said, you could track somebody, but the resolution is so low in the cameras, you can't tell who they are.
Some police officers I know joke that you can photograph the moon, but the second somebody robs someone, it becomes a very complicated affair because the resolution's so bad. Or the other one is where a spider's made a nest over the lens of the camera, and other random things like that.
Right. So I thought that was interesting.
It is. No, and if anything, like the thing I've learned is like the with CCTV, it's like they can piece together things after the fact. So usually, you know, I use that example of that terrible murder of a lady called Sarah Everard by a police officer. And it was this one fragment of CCTV that revealed whose car it was. And that was the moment where they could then retrace the killer's steps. So it's that finding that fragment of information is so vital. So then suddenly you got the whole network that, at your disposal. I believe a lot of CCTV is usually only kept for something like 90 days, I think. That could have changed. But so there's only a short window to kind of get everything before things are kind of wiped. So, yeah.
Interesting. Homicide touched on that a little bit with the guy that murdered the woman online, which was not a surveillance camera, but was one of those sort of points of view from a camera ideas.
Homicide.com, yeah.
Right. And Endgame with Steve Buscemi, terrific episode, sort of wrapping up the shootings of some of the officers. Yes, so Endgame, another terrific episode with Steve Buscemi. And then certainly we talked about the huge story arc with the Adina Watson case throughout the entire series, throughout the entire Homicide series. And Lee comes in and directs Requiem for Adina, which was a really pivotal episode for Kyle. Well, for everybody, but for Kyle, because that particular case weighed so heavily on him and the way he did his job and the fact that he doubted himself and lost confidence and, you know, had arguments with Andre about his detecting style and whether he had let, you know, common knowledge was that he had let the investigation get away from him. And for Lee to come in and be able to direct that such a pivotal episode in the entire arc of the show itself, not just one story arc in one episode, but an arc of the whole show, was really a beautiful episode. And I think it was one of the episodes that Julie Martin wrote.
Oh, it was Julie. Fantastic.
Usually, obviously, a team effort with the writers, but I think she might have been one of the main writers on that. But that's just absolutely terrific. A terrific episode. And it was interesting, also fun to hear Lee's connection to the show through his wife, who is the sister of Barry's wife. But also certainly Lee knew of and knew Barry from the Baltimore film arena. And Lee had been very busy and very well respected as a commercial director here in Baltimore. And also, I just want to say, an absolutely delightful director to work with. I worked with him on a couple commercials, and I don't remember what they were, but I knew him before he came on Homicide. And then when he got on Homicide, just an absolutely delightful person to work with. Never got angry. I mean, he may have gotten flustered, but he hid it. He never seemed to get flustered. I've said this more than once about some of the other crew people, but just a real prince to work with. Really. So kudos to him for being a terrific person to work with. Because sometimes you get, you know, brilliant directors that are not terrific to work with. But he absolutely was, and also produced some of the best episodes of the show. And the joke being that we talked about in the podcast was here, one of the best episodes of the whole series. They never asked him back after that.
I know.
It's just like, why not?
It's crazy, isn't it?
Although the most anybody ever directed, I think, what was the top number six, I think?
Is it? Yeah.
So there's only literally a handful of directors that did multiple episodes, including Lee and Jean. Ken Fink and Alan Taylor were some of the people that did multiple episodes, but nobody did more than a half a dozen out of the 120. So, but Lee was just a terrific tour, and just the same lovely person when we invaded his house and got and talked to him for the interview. He was absolutely terrific and fun also to have Carrie there at the same time.
Did you manage to get lunch at the yacht club?
No, we should have asked him where it was. That was funny.
Yeah.
Carrie and I came back and had lunch in Hampden. I think we probably went to Frasier's. Frasier's on the Avenue. But also, I know it's not a homicide centric, but also, you know, in addition to Do You See What I See, also known as Replay, did he direct The Band That Wouldn't Die and Barry produced it? It was an ESPN production that went around and...
Yeah, because it was his production company, Revolver, because they were on standby, weren't they, for the one of the contributors.
Right. So ESPN did a series of sports-related documentaries that weren't about, you know, players and teams. And this one was about the Colts marching band, who are legendary here in Baltimore for staying together after the Colts vacated the city and eventually morphed into the Ravens marching band, who are also absolutely terrific. I actually worked with one of the Ravens marching band members when I worked at the Baltimore County Department of Health. I want to say she was a trombone player. I think she was some horn player. I can't remember which.
Yeah, yeah. I think Lee directed a segment from it because Barry Levis is the main director. I think if I remember the story correctly, there was a particular member of the band who was living in a home and his health was a bit up and down, but because Lee was local.
No, it was the former mayor, the famous former mayor of Baltimore.
That's it.
Yeah,
that's
it. William Donald Schaefer. The irascible character, Baltimore, loved him or hated him. He was very well loved here in Baltimore generally, but there were also people that didn't like him. But yeah, I think it was Mayor Schaefer who wasn't doing well, but they managed to catch him on a good day. And Lee went over and had a great conversation with him. So I would love to see that. I don't think I've ever seen that. Usually the ESPN productions are really, really, really good. So I have to take a look at that. So interesting to see that. You know, that's sort of the scope of all the different kinds of things Lee did and you know, and bringing that knowledge as a director to the show and producing terrific, absolutely terrific episodes.
Yeah, again, thank you very much, Lee, for your time on the show. I really enjoyed that interview and I hope all of you out there listening did as well. Thank you again for, you know, listening to our podcast. And if you enjoyed this episode, don't forget you can now support us directly by buying us a coffee at buyusacoffee.com and the links in the show notes below. So, you know, thank you again, everybody, for listening and we'll catch you on the next episode. Take care.
Thanks, everyone.